This is our last class for this semester, and I don't know that we'll advance very far, but I want to at least review some things that we went over and talk a little bit more about Jacob and Leah and Rachel. Just to think about it is, and I want to start with the Midrash. I'm going to read you from Midrash Rabbah. Remember, the Midrash is the collection of rabbinic interpretations, elaborations, explanations of the Torah portion. And Midrash Rabbah, Rabbah just means big. Midrash Rabbah is the largest collection of Midrashim. But I'll start with this. Rabbi Pinchas and Rabbi Abahu's name commenced thus, and the rabbis are always concerned to quote if they speak in someone else's name to say who they got it from. Houses and riches are the inheritance of the fathers. This is a verse from Proverbs, but a prudent wife is from God. Said Rabbi Pinchas and Rabbi Abahu's name. Now he's going to comment on that verse, okay? We find in the Torah, the prophets, and the writings that a man's marriage partner is from God. In the Torah it says, and he quotes a couple of other verses, sometimes a man goes to his spouse, and sometimes it is the reverse. In the case of Isaac, his spouse came to him, right? We know that because we read it. As it says, and he saw, and behold, there were camels coming, etc. Jacob, however, went to his spouse, as it is written, and Jacob went out. So first of all, there's a different dynamic at the beginning of the relationship, right? And there's this passage, I have to find it sometime, in one of Milan Kundera's book, I think it's the book of Laughter and Forgetting. He says that you have to be very careful when you first start to go out with someone, because although you don't know it, you're writing the rules for the relationship for the next 20 years. So the first couple of weeks will determine. And in fact, to some extent, this is true. Jacob was the aggressive one, and Jacob determined the nature of the relationship, right? On the other hand, Rebecca was the aggressive one. She's the one who pursued Isaac. And in fact, throughout their relationship, it was Rebecca who turns out to be the aggressive one. So what the rabbis are observing is that the dynamic of the relationship can be often can be told at the very beginning, right? And then comes a very famous midrash. But since it happens to be right here in the classical sources, I'll go on with it. Rabbi Judah commenced his exposition with, a Roman matron asked Rabbi Yossi, how many days did the Holy One, blessed be He, create His world? In 6 days, he answered. Then what's he been doing since then? He sits and makes matches, that is, between men and women. He answered, assigning this man to that woman and this woman to that man. If that is difficult, she said, I can do the same. She went and matched her slaves, giving this man to that woman, this woman to that man, and so on. Sometime after, those who were united went and beat one another, and this woman saying, I don't want this man, while this man protested, I don't want this woman. Straight away, she summoned Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta and said, there's no God like your God. It's true. Your Torah is beautiful and praiseworthy. You spoke the truth. Said he to her, if you think it's easy, you should know that it is as difficult before God as the dividing of the Red Sea to make a good match. In other words, it's that hard. And by the way, in the same Midrash, and then he gives various biblical verses that are supposed to prove that, when they ask, someone else asks, what's God been doing since the time of creation? He says, and this also relates to the Jacob story, the Holy One, blessed be He, sits and makes ladders for one to go up and one to go down, right? From the same Midrash that I mentioned last time. So there is this idea, and it's clear from the Rachel and the Leah story, that in fact matches are problematic. And the whole Bashert idea, which obviously has its origins in the Midrash, the idea that there's one person for whom, you know, that you should be matched to, is both supported and also diminished by the idea that it's as hard to make a good match as it is split the Red Sea. That is, God says it's difficult even for God to make the right match. And also the idea of Bashert, I think, has a lot to do with whether you think the human being is has an essential nature or is constructed. And by that I mean, is there only one person with whom you can build your life, or are there many different people, but you would end up building many different kinds of lives? Right? Those are two different ways of thinking about, in some ways, I understand that some people like the Bashert idea better, but I actually like the second idea better, because it means that you don't have to spend your entire life searching for that one person who, for all you know, could be in Beijing. So that's, I always thought that was a little, right, discouraged, because then it requires a double act of faith, not just that there is a Bashert, but somehow God will put them in your path, and that you'll both be wise enough to recognize it exactly at the time. There's also there's a timing issue with relationships as well. So anyway, all of those are kind of background to Jacob and Leah. And then I brought two more books of commentary on the matchmaking subject. One talks about the fact that Bilhah and Zilpah have been more or less written out of Jewish history, even though they, after all, give birth to how many of the 12 tribes? I don't even know offhand.
Four.
Each of them have two? Each of them have two. To four of the 12 tribes. So that's a third of Israel comes from Bilhah and Zilpah. And what this commentary goes on to say is, of course, that they're doubly disappeared. Because first, they're disappeared in the text. When we talk about our foremothers, we talk about Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Nobody ever says, and Bilhah and Zilpah. And I'll come back to that in a second. And the second part of this is that their children then disappeared in the 10 lost tribes. So they're doubly disappeared, right? The only tribe that really remained was the tribe of Judah. So Bilhah and Zilpah don't get footnoted in history, and they don't, and their offspring disappear in history. The change here, I think, is that Bilhah and Zilpah are not married but property, and so it's a class issue, not as much of a religious issue. But it does make you wonder whether their children were treated differently. There's no indication of that in the text, at least none that I'm aware of. Okay, so the names I get, this is Rachel talking. The names I gave Bilhah's two sons express my own bitter disappointment. Dan, which I meant to mean God has vindicated me, and Naphtali, which means a fateful contest I waged. What a hollow victory these births were to me. So both of them also, her children are named for revenge, in a way. And remember that it's between the two of them, it's a very, very interesting contest before Rachel has her own children. Right? And even then, Rachel dies early. It's hard to know, right, which would you, who in the end really does best, Leah or Rachel? Is it better to be long-lived, unloved, and fertile, or short-lived, loved and right? And actually, she has two children, so you can't say the end, but it was difficult for her to have those children. And then lastly, before we get back to the text itself, several very interesting Hasidic comments also on our Parsha. And here, one, the Mei Shiloach, he was a fascinating guy, talks about Isaac's blessing of Jacob and asks the question, why would God want Isaac to bless Jacob without knowing that it was Jacob? You can understand why Jacob wanted it, because he's afraid if Isaac knows, he won't bless him. You can understand why Rebekah wants it. But why does God want it? Presumably God could inspire Isaac or teach Isaac that he's supposed to bless Jacob first, just like he told Rachel. So why doesn't he just tap Isaac on the shoulder and say, by the way, bless Jacob as the firstborn son? And His answer is that if Isaac had blessed Jacob knowingly, the blessing would only have as much force as Isaac could put into it, because it would be a conscious blessing. But an unconscious blessing draws not only on the force that you create, but also the force that you're not aware of. That is, he was blessing Jacob in ways he didn't even understand. And it was deeper because he wasn't aware of it than it would have been if he was aware of it. Which is a very interesting, now, the Me'a Shiloach is one of those writers who never says anywhere near as much as he means. Everything is a hint with him. So you have to think about what that means to bless someone consciously or unconsciously, and how much of what you transmit, for example, to your children, do you not discover until years later? Right? Because you were giving them messages all the time that you weren't aware of, and those messages that they picked up from you that you weren't aware of were often more powerful than the messages that you were aware of. And so the same thing is true with blessings, in a way. That the conscious blessings that we set up and we do are less powerful than what they feel from us that we don't, right, consciously do. And you can all think of examples in your life about messages that you got from parents that weren't conscious messages but were very powerful. And if you said them to your parents, they would be surprised that that's what they were transmitting to you, because they weren't aware of it, right? It was so perfectly natural. Anyway, so I thought that was an interesting point. And then it says something about Leah's eyes. And this I also thought was wonderful. Remember, there was a discussion that we had about Leah's eyes being rakot, weak, which could also mean soft. Rach is also soft. And there is, bless you, a dispute among both ancient and modern scholars whether this is supposed to be flattering or unflattering to Leah. So here's what the Nitziv, who is actually was not a Hasidic scholar, but is the head of the Volozhin Yeshiva, says that explains why Rachel was a shepherdess and she wasn't. Her eyes were too sensitive to go out in the sun. That really what it means is sensitive. And therefore, according to the Zohar, taking off on the same idea, Rachel represents the external world and Leah is the hidden world. Because Leah used to stay indoors. She couldn't go outside. She couldn't be in the sun. And that Leah is therefore private, hidden, and inward. And as a result, Yaakov marries both. Right? Both the external world, that is the world of beauty, which is Rachel's world, and also the internal world, which is the world of Leah. And remember, it's Leah's son who ends up being the precursor to the Messiah, not right from Judah. So for what it's worth, I thought that was an interesting, where are we? That was an interesting precursor to, or prelude to reading again. And we had talked last time about the dialogue between Jacob and Rachel, where she says, you know, give me children or I will die. And then Jacob gets upset and says, it's not my doing. And now we come to verse 14. By the way, does anyone know what a mandrake is?
What?
A mandrake. It's one of those, and it's divided up into two. It has like a root that has two stalks, which is why it looks like a man. Hence a mandrake, and also you can understand why it would be a fertility plant, right? Because mandrake, it's called. What's that?
What you refer to those midrash? When were they written?
Which ones? The Midrash Bereishit Rabba, probably 4th-5th century CE. Yeah. It doesn't mean that they're not based on earlier interpretations, though. But yeah.
So the plant looks like a man.
Yes.
Oh,
okay. Mandrakes. The Hebrew dudaim have been identified with Mandragoria officinarum. Does that help you? It grows wild in the field. Its small, yellow, tomato-like fruit ripens during March and April. Chemical analysis shows it to contain emetic, purgative, and narcotic substances, which explains its widespread medicinal use in ancient times. because the fruit exudes a distinctive and heady fragrance, and its sturdy, forked, or intertwined root has torso-like features, in other words, it looks like a person, the mandrake appears as a widely diffused folkloric myth associated with aphrodisiac powers. In other words, it's supposed to get you to want to go to bed, not to sleep. Just thought I would clarify that. Okay, so all right. Once again, by the way, in this story, apparently God is mentioned seven times. One time at the wheat harvest, Reuven came upon some mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother Leah. There's a different Hasidic interpretation, which actually goes back to something that someone said last week in class about the idea that what you're thinking of when you have sex influences the child, right? So I don't remember who it was. I can look it up. I don't remember which commentator it was. It was a modern mystical commentator. By modern, I mean like in the last couple hundred years. There's a professor at the seminary who used to say that everything after the Spanish Inquisition, which was 1492, in Judaism was journalism. You know, so it was the last couple hundred years. He said that the reason that Reuven, who was the firstborn, the reason Reuven didn't end up being the leader of Israel, and in fact didn't even end up in Israel, because remember, Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Menashe stay on the second side. They don't go over into the land. They ask Moses if they can have land on the other side of the Jordan, is because when Jacob was sleeping with Leah, he thought it was Rachel. And therefore, because he wasn't focused on the person that he was with, the offspring wasn't fully pure, and Reuven lost his chance to be the leader of Israel, which is kind of an interesting idea, although, you know, it's problematic in other ways. Among other things, you don't want the child to be captive to the intentions of the parents during sex, because what if you remember that was a bad experience? Are you going to transfer that onto the child? So, you know, mystically it's a nice idea, but in real life it can have bad consequences. So basically the lesson here is, if the experience was positive, then you transfer that onto the child, right? You say you were a product of love, but if not, then you just don't mention it. There was this stork. So Reuven comes in, he has mandrakes. Rachel says to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, was it not enough for you to take away my husband that you would also take away my son's mandrakes? Now, one of the things that the commentaries point out is that Leah, unlike Rachel, I don't think Rachel ever does this, Leah always refers to Jacob as my husband. Because I think she feels that was what was supposed to be. Now, here you see the rivalry explicitly in a way that you don't see it before this. Before this, we could say, well, maybe, you know, they really got along and the sharing was nice and the government shouldn't have gone in and taken their children because polygamy is fine. See, everything old is new again. All you have to do is watch the news. It's the same story. But in fact, it's you know what it is? I should have brought the whole poem. But the end, there's a wonderful poem by Auden, and the end of it is, it says, it's the fault or the flaw that's bred in the bone, not the desire to be loved, but the desire to be loved alone. In other words, you don't really want anyone else, right? It's every doctor you go into, you don't want them to have other patients, right? You don't want it, it's true. You don't want the teacher to have other students. You don't want the spouse to have other spouses. I mean, to jump from. Everybody wants to be loved alone. I mean, who wants to be, you know, part of a group of people. That's why it's so difficult when you're in a group to part of you can meld into the group, but part of you wants to be separate from. And the more important the object is of your attention or affection, like in a political rally, you see how people reach out to touch the candidate because it's true that they're part of a large group, but they want to be individually touched and separately touched and loved alone. And that's what that's clearly what's going on here. Is I can't imagine that anybody in a polygamous marriage they have basically two choices. Either they must have some resentment or they really have to sublimate their ego to be able to do that. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'll leave to you, but that's what you have to do. But she said to her, but Rachel replied, "I promise she shall lie with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." Now this makes me think, although I don't know this for sure, that Jacob wasn't sleeping with Leah, right? That he would sleep with Rachel, except when he said, you know, I want to have another kid, so bring this one in or that one in. Because remember, Leah with Judah has stopped bearing children, and now she has to. The truth is that the word that Sarna uses is exactly right. It's pathetic, right? He says the pathetic nature, in other words, it's sad, of this barter arrangement is underlined by the striking fact that the word shakav, which is used, yishkav, right, which is the word to sleep with, when employed in Genesis with a sexual nuance, never connotes a relationship of marital love, but is invariably used in unsavory circumstances, right? That's yada is the word that's usually used when it's, you know, like Adam and Eve. It's yada, which is knowledge. Shachav is just to sleep with someone. Also what I find interesting about this is Jacob's lack of participation here. He comes in and, you know, is directed towards this bet or that bet. And his disconnection with all of this is striking. I mean, where is he while all of this is going on? Bilhah, Zilpah, Leah, Rachel, you know. He's like a stud service, not a husband. Whoever they put in front of him, he's happy to sleep with. How do you fit? I didn't say poor Jacob. That I did not say. You know why you feel sorry for him? Why does she feel sorry for him? Because she's a woman. But I've never heard a man say, poor Jacob. Poor Jacob, Bilhah, Zilpah. But what I do really wonder, and all kidding aside, what I really do wonder is this in any way consistent with what we know about Jacob up to now? I don't know. I mean, how do you fit it in? What's that?
I think it's a new Sodom. I think it was like the shadow of his brother all the time. And now he's either rebelling or just going back to when he was never allowed to do anything like that at home. Maybe, I don't know.
Right, he wasn't allowed. Probably wasn't.
He was a good boy.
Right, he was a good boy. He clearly had tremendous energies that weren't tapped at home. And I don't only mean that, I mean the fact that he could leave by himself, that he could make his way, that he lifted the stone from the well. In other words, this is, and I say that also because he's closer to Abraham than Isaac that way. And you can imagine Abraham, right? Abraham sleeps with Hagar, but Isaac you can't imagine actually living this kind of life, right? Isaac is much quieter. Esau, you can imagine. Jacob, you can imagine. And remember, they were twins. So, yeah.
Maybe it was normal back then. Everybody would have like few wives.
It wasn't unusual. It was not unusual. Right. We know that it wasn't unusual. So, yes.
To marry to
mentioned.
Yes.
Totally
yes.
Routine,
yes. Yep.
When he loved him a lot, he got another wife also after Rachel.
So, well, he actually gets another wife before Rachel. What he gets after Rachel is one before Rachel and two concubines after. They're not wives. They're the wives' handmaidens. And all right, so there are two answers to this. One is a physical answer and one is a story answer. The physical answer is that the connection between sex and love isn't always that close, right? And the fact that Jacob has sex with other women doesn't mean that he doesn't love Rachel, right? The second side of this is that what he wants and what his wife wants is children. Well, he didn't get paid at the beginning, but we'll see what happens. He doesn't get wages the way he thinks he should, and then he'll get wages by a sort of miraculous means. But he will get paid in the end, even though Laban does so unwillingly. Here's what I would say. The first part is that Jacob lives in a polygamous world, in a world where there are multiple marriages, and in a world where everything, or much of everything, not everything as we saw last time, but everything is about having children because they're the ones who are going to inherit his property and so on. Having said that, it's also true that Rachel brings her handmaiden to him and says, right, so here's the sequence. Jacob first unwillingly marries somebody that he doesn't love, okay? Then the question is he now going to take another wife whom he does love? So he figures, just because Laban cheated me doesn't mean that I shouldn't marry the person whom I actually do love. So he marries Rachel. He has children with Leah, who after all is his wife, right? And then Rachel, who can't have children, says, since I can't have children, I want you to have kids with my handmaiden. So he says, okay. Because this is the woman he loves who can't have children and wants to have children, so she does it through her handmaiden. So he has children through her handmaiden. At that point, of course, he also ends up having children with Rachel, and Leah brings her handmaiden and says, well, how come you can sleep with her handmaiden and have children? What about mine? So Jacob says, okay. But what I want to say is that that's why there are two sides to it. According to the story, you could understand how he could really love Rachel and still be caught up in this. But also you can understand how he might be able to separate his sexuality from his love, which are functions that are like a DNA spiral, right? Sometimes they go together and sometimes they move apart in someone's life. Yeah.
Right. Is that like the end of the age story?
Yes.
To me the same. He married his brother's wife because he had to, he didn't love her.
Right.
And he married somebody because he loved. And then so being with the
There's a lesson in this.
So
right.
The lesson is when there's no limitation, there is chaos.
Right.
Basically.
Yes.
So I can understand why he would take Rachel's handmaiden to have children in order to
Right.
Because she asked him to. Well, why would he take Leah's? Because he has had children.
I guess because she, right, more children. The more children, the better, for both reasons. One, because so many die. And so in the ancient world, if you could have more children. And second, it may be that after four children, Leah couldn't have more children but wanted more. And so why should he refuse her if she wants him to do this? And she wants the children to be counted on her, Cheshbon. Yeah.
It seems clearly, too, that this is an extraordinary tale about the women and their power struggle with each other.
Yes.
Historically, it has been a problem that women have with each other, not only power struggle with their men, but between each other. And here, there's who's going to have more kids? And the more kids that Leah has, she's constantly trying to one up. Rachel, well, okay. And this to me has a lot of deep aspects just for women to explore. We're talking about Jacob.
Here's what Rachel says. Poor, unloved Leah, you wanted so much to win Jacob's heart. Although you pretended you were doing me a favor by offering me the mandrakes in exchange for an extra night in Jacob's bed, because the mandrakes were fertility, right? So it was like Leah was doing her a favor. I saw through your ruse. And when you realized that I did, you accused me. Wasn't it enough for you to take away my husband, that you also take away my son's mandrakes? Couldn't you have a little more compassion? Leah explains, it didn't matter anyway, because when I said to Jacob, you're to sleep with me, for I've hired you with my son's mandrakes, Jacob complied with no more passion than a prostitute, and I felt the same. Now, remember, the Bible doesn't say that. That's her interpretation of how, but maybe it is that at a certain point, Jacob gets dutiful, right? It's just like, okay, you know, because obviously he wasn't sleeping with Leah. Yeah. Right.
Especially Esau.
Esau is not. And I think the only way to answer that is the acceptance of the father, that they are part of the line. Right? Obviously, for Abraham and for Isaac, for whatever reason, maybe because of, and for Abraham because of his wife, but not just that, or maybe even the acceptance of the mother. Sarah didn't want her handmaiden's kid to be part of the inheritance, so he wasn't. Rebecca didn't seem to want Ishmael to be part of the inheritance, so he wasn't. But Leah and Rachel did want their handmaiden's kids, so they were. I mean, that's too simple, but it seems like it's working that way. Yeah.
You might have covered this, but if Laban gives Rachel over a week after they make the
right
deal for 7 more years, so why then, therefore, does he stay for 7 years?
Because he promised he would.
Oh, but he was Laban.
Yeah, I know, but he said he would, so I guess he did. Or maybe he didn't have another way to make a living. I mean, it's possible that it was also self-interest. He had a home there, he had a job, you know, and he had two wives that he needed to support all of a sudden, right? Yeah.
The contempt that Rachel has for Leah to say that I cannot have a child, so go sleep with my handmaid, rather than, okay, my sister is bringing you children. But there is this deep, deep rivalry or a spite or contempt.
She wants her own. She wants her own.
But it's not her own.
Leah's the older sister, you know?
But she, even by blood, the sister's child is closer
but
to her than
yes.
The handmaid.
The sister's child is, but she doesn't own the sister. She owns the handmaiden. What can I tell you? I mean, I understand what you're saying, and it's true. But you know, I mean, we all know this. The same thing that makes siblings so close are what makes rivalries so powerful. So, you know, she has no rivalry with Bilhah or Zilpah, but she does with Leah. In Judaism, it depends where you're talking about. In Western Europe, in Christian lands, polygamy stopped in the early Middle Ages. In Arab lands, it didn't stop in some countries until the founding of the State of Israel. In fact, when Israel was founded, some places like Yemen, Jews came with more than one wife, and the State of Israel said, your polygamy is no longer allowed. If you come with more than one wife, obviously we're not going to say, you know, pick one out of three, but but from then on, it's not permitted. So that's because in parts of the Arab world, in the Muslim world, polygamy was still permitted. So, yeah.
2 points. You mentioned something about Rachel being the outer room or external room, and Leah being the inner room.
Yeah.
Even Jacob, as a righteous man, chooses the external room, and the inner room or internal room is supposed to be imposed on him.
Right.
So this is a point that, you know, even a righteous man does. And the second thing is, Jacob is supposed to be righteous. But it seems that it was predestined for him to be righteous. He didn't really do something to be righteous. He was chosen to be righteous.
So there are two very suggestive comments. The first one was, if you didn't hear it, even Jacob, who's supposed to be righteous, and in fact, that's one of the things, one of the interesting comments that he makes in here. Do you know what Sfirah, by the way, what Jacob is supposed to represent? Emet. He represents truth, interestingly enough, right? Why? Because through his life of deceit, he comes eventually to value truth, right, towards the end of his life, but obviously has to work his way through. And I'll tell you something about that in a second. Emet, which is balanced truth and completeness. So he has to have both in a way, right? He has to have the inner and the outer world if he's going to be balanced, truthful, and complete. There's a midrash that when God wanted to create the world, the angels said, you know, how can you create human beings? They'll be violent, they'll be this, they'll be that. And then truth comes forward and says they'll be untruthful, and God throws truth to the ground and creates the world, as if to say human beings might have a chance one day to be nonviolent, they might have a chance to be kind, but they'll never ever make it to truthful. The question was, even Jacob, who's supposed to be this righteous man, has to have inwardness forced on him. That is, he doesn't choose Leah. He chooses the external. He chooses Rachel. He chooses the outer world. That may be one of the Torah's subtle comments on the essential nature, natural difference between men and women. That's just, you know, that's who Jacob is. Jacob is a man. And ultimately, he's going to live in the external world and not in the internal world. So, And while it's too much of a typology, obviously, right? Women live externally and men live internally too. And everybody is on a continuum. Some men live more in the internal world, some women live more in the external world. Still, I mean, anybody who has eyes to see knows that that's a powerful difference. And the second comment was, what was the second comment? About all through the Torah, the question is, why does God choose these people? And do they prove themselves first, or are they chosen first? Jacob actually works better than most according to this model, because he's got both. Jacob is chosen because he's born into the line, but he also earns it along the way. Right, as we'll see, I mean, Jacob really struggles. He struggles, first of all, after his initial deception. And remember that he grows up in a house where his father prefers his brother. So even though his mother prefers him, that's already a house which has to have at least some kind of, you know, tension, to say the least. He runs away on his own. He has to work 14 years. His brother comes to kill him. He has to, you know, which not to give the plot away of what happens later, but his brother comes to kill him. He struggles with the angel. He has a reconciliation. Then as an old man, his favorite child is taken away and killed, as far as he knows. He finally has to travel to Egypt for a last reconciliation. And his last words are basically, after he blesses his children, don't kill each other after I'm gone. So Jacob really... he has to earn his way more almost than any other biblical character. Let's just fill in the rest of the children before we because there is a kicker at the end. When Jacob came home from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, "You're to sleep with me, for I've hired you with my son's mandrakes." Even that is so, you know. And you can almost hear her bitterness, you know? Not that you would want to sleep with me because I'm your wife or anything, but I hired you, and so you have to sleep with me tonight. And all it says is, Vayishkavima balailahu. All it says, he slept with her that night. It doesn't say nothing, no reaction. Jacob is completely silent, which I find really very sad. And the word for hired, ki sachor, sachar ticha, is the name of the child that results from this. Yisachar comes from this, right? In other words, it was a result of a hire, which is also, you know, unpleasant to say the least. God heeded Leah, and she conceived and bore him a fifth son. And Leah said, God has given me my reward. Reward is schari, right? Schar. But it also harkens back to hire. For having given my maid to my husband. All right? So notice what she assumes the reward is for. For being willing to do the same thing that Rachel is willing to do. When Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son, Leah said, God has given me a choice gift. This time my husband will exalt me, for I've borne him six sons, Zevulun, which comes from Zeved to grant, but also Zevel is raise up. So lastly, she bore him a daughter and named her Dinah. Now, this is, we've heard nothing about a daughter. We'll hear much more about Dinah shortly. But this raises the question, if she had to hire him to sleep with her, to get Yisachar, how come all of a sudden these other children are born, right? I mean, did he forget about her and that night together reminded him of Leah? That's possible. Yeah, you think?
She got him back on track.
Mm-hmm. Right, Rachel still, but.
So it's really inconvenient to do it when you're
happy. And also remember that the Torah doesn't necessarily write chronologically. So it doesn't have to be that she slept with him, had another kid, slept with him, had another kid, slept with him, had another kid. And obviously with, the requisite time in between. Because it says now God remembered Rachel. God heeded her and opened her womb. That could have been after she got the mandrakes. Who knows? Although she would have had to prepare them for several months because Leah got pregnant. No, actually not, because she could have slept with him the next night. Who knows? It doesn't say when they were born, and they don't have to have been born in sequence, right? Rachel and Leah could have gone into labor the same time. And she said, God has taken away my disgrace, right? Asaf Elohim et Cherpati. That's where Yosef comes from. So she names him Joseph, which can also come from a root about add, but it can also mean taken away. So it's a very, Rachel later, of course, is going to give Benjamin, who is going to be literally the death of her. But Joseph is particularly treasured because he's the one who enabled her to be a mother. Yeah.
I'm interested to go back to the line of truth. Now God remembered Rachel. Is that the same word he said, God remembered the children
of
Israel?
Yes. When God, the thing is, when, again, to think of it literally is to sort of do violence to the text. It's not that God forgot and then remembered. Took note of is the way it's sometimes translated. God took note of, or God paid attention to, or God acted towards. But if you think, the way the theologians will tell you is that this is our emotional explanation of God's actions, that all we really know are God's actions, and we attribute human-like internal states to them. So we see God do something, and we say, oh, God remembered. But it doesn't really mean that God remembered. What we're really saying is God now did something. So the Torah's way of saying that God enabled Rachel to be pregnant is God remembered Rachel. But we can't draw an analogy between our... there was an interest... Where was the article? I thought this was really fascinating. There was an article that I read this morning, and I don't remember where I printed it out from. I got it somewhere off the copious, sources of the internet. About the debate that's still going on in mathematics, whether mathematics is a human construct or exists in the world. That is, do human beings invent that 2 and 2 is 4, or did they discover that 2 and 2 is 4? And there are mathematicians on both sides of this. On one side, people say if they invented it, then how come we can't invent that 2 and 2 is 5? Even if we want to, right? If it's all about invention. On the other hand, there are people who say, well, if you believe that 2 and 2 is 4, then there has to be some kind of pre-existing realm some kind of like magical idea before people come along to discover it. And of course, none of them want to say God. So I was reading the article thinking, well, yeah, we did discover it. We didn't invent it. Two and two actually are four. Even if we weren't around, two and two would be four. But we have a very, it's hard not to attribute to the world our workings, right? I mean, because we're all we know. So it's hard to imagine that two and two is four in a way that's different from books are our invention, right? Anyway, so when God does something, the Torah always uses human language, which is what the rabbis say. All right, so any questions or comments? We're early, but I don't want to start a new thing and that Jacob and Laban will take too long. Yes. Well, they're not all boys, because Dina was just born. Right. But you mean all the, like, Esav and Yishmael, and right. Yeah. Right. Right. Oh, endless symbolic interpretation. The question was, is there symbolic as opposed to literal interpretation? Yes, endless symbolic. Well, I mean, for example, when we talk about Yaakov representing truth, that's a symbolic or an allegorical interpretation. So that's symbolic. And in terms of the children being boys, I would give maybe two different answers. One is that boys were coveted. So it's a way of saying they did well, right? Because you want, if you had children in the ancient world and you had boys, then you had a chance that they would inherit your property, right? And later on, that's going to be an issue, you remember, with the daughters of Tzlofchad, whether they can inherit the property of their father because they don't have brothers. And in the end, they can, but they had to bring the question to Moses, and Moses didn't know the answer. Moses had to go to God. And the second part of it, I think, is that if you want to create tribes, the tribes have to be under the name of a man. I am not aware of any tribes in the ancient world that bore a woman's name. Yeah.
So don't you think it's unusual, given the mortality rate of infants, that all his children lived?
Yes, I do. And the only thing I can say is it possible that there were any children who died at birth? Yeah, it's possible. It is certainly possible. I don't know, you know, and it's not just in the ancient, I don't know how many of you ever read, for example, Angela's Ashes, the Frank McCourt book. It's a wonderful book about, I mean, it's horrible, but it's wonderful. It's about his growing up in Ireland, and it's very painful to read, but it's brilliantly done. It's made less painful because it's so funny and acute, and so it was a huge bestseller several years ago. And we're talking about growing up in Ireland before the Second World War, so in the 20s and 30s, and three of his siblings died. I think he ends up with three brothers, and two brothers and one sister die. And while it was horrible, nobody said, oh my God, I can't believe that you actually had children who died, right? And nobody spoke about it as you would today, as the most horrible, epical thing that could ever happen to a mother that is unprecedented, because all around her, other people had children who died. So even though it was clearly the worst thing in their lives and the worst thing in his mother's life, other than the fact that her father kept drinking and never brought home the money that he made, but that world gives you a sense of, even though his family happened to be worse off than most of the families around there, it gave you a sense that children dying, the expectation that children will of course not die is very modern, very modern.
Judah comes from Leah, so that means she was a significant matriarch.
Yes.
When you read the Siddur, the new version for women, mm-hmm. there is Sarah, Rebecca, and then Rachel and Leah.
Right.
How come Leah, although she was not loved first, but she was married to him for any reason for the rabbis?
I guess I don't know why it was chosen as Rachel and Leah rather than Leah and Rachel. Unless that was Jacob's intention, was Rachel and Leah. And also, it sounds better it's more alliterative if you have Rebecca, Rachel, as opposed to, you know, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Velea sounds better than Sarah, Rivka, Leah, Verachel. So maybe they did it also on assonance. It just sounds better. Yes, Norm.
I recently was in a synagogue where during the Amidah, they did say Sarah, Rivka, Leah.
Really?
It's in the Reform. It's in the Reform.
The Reform puts Leah first. Yes? That's interesting. So I don't know. But I actually have to call Jules Harlow, who wrote the Sim Shalom Sidur about something else. So I'll ask him. I'll ask him. Yeah, I'll get back to you on that. I'll ask him why he did that. Right. Yeah. Yes.
I'd just like to say, for people who have not been to Israel, these characters are buried in a place called Hebron, and you can go there and see. I mean, you don't see the real graves, but there are tombs devoted to these people.
Right. And also Kever Rachel on the road. Right. You can also see Rachel's grave. In Ma'arat HaMachpelah, right.
You can't go there anymore.
What's that? You can go to Hebron. Yeah. Yeah, I mean.
Don't people go to Rachel's grave?
Right, yes.
For fertility?
Yep. Yes.
In the stone Lumish, they say the name Yisachar has two shins in it, but we don't pronounce the one shin because one is represents for hire, the other reward. Uh-huh. But
that's
are there
nice.
Any other
I like
instances
that.
Where the rabbis determine how you would pronounce a word?
Oh, constantly. In fact, there are two. There's a tradition, Kri and Ketiv. Kri is how it reads, and Ketiv is how.